As the children are being dismissed to children's church, I invite you to open with me in your Bibles to Exodus chapter 17. It's page 54 in the Old Testament if you're using the Pew Bible. Exodus chapter 17. Do you know what we like in our lives? Smooth sailing. We like life to go well. We don't like interruptions. We don't like challenges. We don't like heartaches. But that's just not how life works yet. There's a coming day where Christ will bring that kind of life about, but that's not where we are yet. On the sea of life, it's often like there's just another storm around the next bend. Now, I'm not a pessimist by nature, but I do think it's important that we be a realist. Sometimes life is hard. Sometimes life is challenging beyond our understanding. Sometimes we want to ask the question, why is this happening to me? Can you relate to that at times in your life? And when we face those kinds of things in our lives, how do we respond? How do we respond with any sense of victory at all? I think we find answers to those kinds of questions in the passage we're looking at this morning in Exodus chapter 17. There is an important key to victory no matter what we face in life, and we find it right here in the second book of the Old Testament. The book of Exodus tells us a fascinating story. It's a story of the or from the history of the nation of Israel. The nation of Israel had been in Egypt for over 400 years as slaves. And in this remarkable turn of events, God goes to Moses, calls Moses to lead the nation of Israel out of Egypt. And they did. And it was quite an exodus. 2 million people, approximately, in one day left Egypt. You realize that's about the population of the whole state of Nebraska. That was a huge change. And it's a wonderful story. If you look on the map here with me briefly, this kind of shows where they were headed. They had been in this area in Egypt near Goshen. They crossed the Red Sea. We're not exactly sure where that would have been. Probably here. They'd come down into what's called the desert of sin. They'd been wonderfully released from bondage. Now they're finally on their own. They're headed toward good things. In the desert of sin, they found out that God provided for them in wonderful ways with manna and with quail. And then they're headed toward Mount Sinai, where they will receive the Ten Commandments. So this was not very long into their wilderness journey when they hit a place called Rephidim. But when they got to Rephidim, there was a huge problem. This was out in the Judean wilderness. I've been there. I saw nothing green, and I mean nothing. They were out in the wilderness, and there was no water. That's a problem when there are 2 million of you with all of your livestock. But instead of trusting God, who'd done so much for them up to that point, they began to grumble and complain. That's what's talked about in the early part of Exodus chapter 17. They complained to Moses. They were so upset that Moses was actually afraid they were going to kill him, stone him to death. So Moses went to God and he said, "What should I do?" And the Lord told him, "What I want you to do is I want you to take your staff, your shepherd's staff, and I want you to smite a rock, and that's exactly what Moses did. He hit the rock with that staff, and water came out, enough water for 2 million people plus animals. That's a lot of water. It's a wonderful miracle. But at the end of that, in verse 7 of chapter 17 of Exodus, we read that he, Moses, named the place Massah, which means testing, and Meribah, which means quarreling. That seems like a very unique thing to do, to name a region like that. Like, well, let's head over to quarreling. Let's head over to testing later on if you were to make a journey to that area. And the reason he did that is because they had quarreled against him and against the Lord. They had tested the Lord God, and he wanted them to remember that. But I think there's also a part of him that wanted them to remember God's grace. Because even though they had been totally obnoxious toward God, totally obnoxious toward Moses, God still gave them water. Anyone who says there's no grace in the Old Testament doesn't read the Old Testament very carefully. This is an amazing act of grace. If God had given them what they deserved, he would have wiped them all out. Spared Moses, wiped the rest of them out. But he didn't. He gave them water. And now he's going to show them grace again in the very same location, Rephidim. That's where we pick up the story in verse 8. Then Amalek came and fought against Israel at Rephidim. Amalek, sometimes referred to as the Amalekites, they were a Bedouin tribe. They were a large group of people. They were nomadic people. They lived in the area, and they didn't like the idea of these 2 million people coming into their region. That was their area, they thought. They were trying to protect it. This is ours. You can't have it. But I think there's something even deeper here, because Amalek was a descendant of Esau. And so this was really a people group that descended from Esau. Remember Jacob and Esau? The story of Jacob and Esau? And Esau in the New Testament is referred to as a godless man. Also, God had promised that there would be a deliverer who would come through the promised line of Jacob, Esau's twin brother. And at one point in the Old Testament, Esau tried to kill Jacob, wanted to kill him. At his earliest convenience, he would have killed him. It's interesting that this many generations later, the descendants of Esau were still trying to kill the descendants of Jacob, whose name was later changed to Israel. This is a big picture. We need to understand the big picture here. This is part of the satanic opposition to the line of the Messiah. No wonder Israel has been opposed over and over again throughout history. Satan hates the Messiah and will do everything he can to disrupt it. But that's what's taking place here, is that big picture idea of the line of the Messiah being disrupted, and this army attacking. Now, we are not told exactly what happened when they attacked here in Exodus, but it's very interesting at the end of Deuteronomy, in Deuteronomy chapter 9, as Moses looks back on this event, he tells us more details of the attack. He said that Amalek attacked the rear of the group of Israelis, the Israelites, the nation of Israel. He attacked the stragglers. That people group attacked them at their most vulnerable point. We don't know exactly what happened. Maybe at that point Israel was sort of able to defend themselves. But they came and fought against Israel, and it's very clear that Moses at that point then realized there's going to be a big battle the next day, and that's what we read about in verse 9. So Moses said to Joshua, "Choose men for us and go out to fight against Amalek. Tomorrow I will station myself on the top of the hill with the staff of God in my hand." Now think about what's happening here. Moses comes to Joshua. By the way, that's the first time he's mentioned in the Bible, Joshua. And he says, "Choose men and go out and fight against Amalek." And he's talking about tomorrow, because he says, "Tomorrow I'm going to go up on that hillside with the staff of God in my hand." So what he's saying to Joshua is, "Joshua, you have one day. You have one day to assemble an entire army and be fully prepared to fight off this enemy who's trying to destroy us, to wipe us out." Now, we need to realize this is the first time in Israel's history they ever had to fight back. Now, if you know anything of the history of the nation of Israel, you know that in ancient history and in even more recent history, even today, Israel has a lot of enemies, people trying to destroy them. They've been through a lot of battles, a lot of wars. But this is the first time they ever had to fight back. Yes, when they left Egypt, they had to cross the Red Sea to get away from the Egyptian army who was pursuing them, but they didn't have to fight back. They simply walked through the water that God parted in the Red Sea, and then God put the water back over the enemy, and that was that. The battle was over. This is the first time they ever had to engage in battle on the battlefield. So Moses is saying to Joshua, "You have one day to assemble an army that's never been assembled before and to be ready to attack for your life. Be ready to fight against the attack and be ready to fight for your lives. One day." Any military person would tell you that's impossible. And you're going to need a lot of help. And so Moses understood that as well, and so he talks about the help. He says, "I'm going to be involved too, but I'm not going on the battlefield with you. I'm going to go to the top of the hill with the staff of God." And he's very specific, "with the staff of God in my hand." You may not realize it, but the staff of God is extremely important. It's talked a lot about in Exodus. As a matter of fact, as I reviewed this story this last week as I was preparing, I was almost surprised at how often I read about the staff of God. It shows up all the time. And I think some of you will remember some of the flow of the story. You may remember the story in Exodus 3 where some of this story kind of began. Moses was out pasturing his flock. Remember the story? He's out pasturing his flock and he sees this burning bush. And he goes up to the burning bush and the burning bush starts talking to him. It's God speaking to him from the burning bush. And He had his staff in his hand, and God says, "I want you to lead the nation of Israel out of Egypt." And Moses was thinking, "I'm not sure I want this job." And so, as you can see on the screen, we're going to review just the beginning of this story, because this is the first place where the staff of God is first talked about. It says, "Then Moses said, 'What if they will not believe me or listen to what I say?'" He's talking to God. "For they may say, 'The Lord has not appeared to you,' and the Lord said to him, 'What is in your hand?' And he said, 'A staff.' Then God said, 'Throw it on the ground.' So he threw it on the ground, and it became a serpent, and Moses fled from it." Isn't that a great story? "But the Lord said to Moses, 'Stretch out your hand and grasp it by the tail.' So he stretched out his hand and caught it, and it became a staff in his hand. 'That they may believe that the Lord, the God of their fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob has appeared to you.'" I don't think I will ever pick up a snake by the tail. I don't even want to pick them up near the head. I don't even want to touch them. God says to Moses, "Pick that thing up by its tail," and immediately became a staff. Remarkable story. I think he had Moses' attention. But that staff was to be used to prove and to convince people that God had sent him. So then if we jump ahead a little bit, a few more verses in Exodus chapter 4 to verse 17, he says, "You shall take in your hand this staff." There's the importance of the staff. "In which you shall perform the signs." Then Moses departed and returned to Jethro, his father-in-law, and said to him, "Please let me go that I may return to my brethren who are in Egypt and see if they are still alive." And Jethro said to Moses, "Go in peace." Now the Lord said to Moses in Midian, "Go back to Egypt, for all the men who are seeking your life are dead." So Moses took his wife and his sons and mounted them on a donkey and returned to the land of Egypt. Moses also took the staff of God in his hand. Moses' shepherd's staff became the staff of God. And when Moses headed toward Egypt to lead the nation out of bondage, he made sure he had the staff of God. And that staff has a major role to play over and over again. You probably remember part of the story. When he stood in front of Pharaoh, he threw his staff down, and that staff became a serpent again. Well, Moses had seen that before, and it's very interesting that Pharaoh's magicians, through, I believe, satanic power, were able to do the same thing with their staffs. But do you remember what happened to their staffs? Moses' staff swallowed their staffs. That would have had a vivid, that is quite a vivid picture of what took place that day. And then the staff had a major role to play in some of the 10 plagues that convinced Pharaoh to let the people go from the nation of Egypt. He touched the Nile and it turned to blood. He touched the Nile with the staff. The staff was held out over the Nile and other water, and frogs came out of the Nile and just were spread all over Egypt. He tapped the staff on the ground, and gnats, thick gnats, came all over the land of Egypt. When Moses held the staff up to the sky, thunder and lightning and hail came. When another time he held the staff out and a strong east wind came and locusts came, and it tells us that it just blackened the surface of the earth. There were so many locusts and they didn't leave anything green behind. And then Moses kept that staff of God after they left Egypt, and he goes to the Red Sea and the armies of Pharaoh are coming behind him, and he held that staff over the Red Sea and the sea parted and they walked right through. And then he gets to the other side, all 2 million plus animals made it across the Red Sea, and they get to the other side and Moses held the staff of God out again and the waters closed and Pharaoh's chariots and horses and armies were drowned. And then, as we just talked about in Exodus 17, he uses the staff of God to smite, to hit the rock, and water gushed out. And now he's talking about the staff of God one more time. This is the last time the staff of God is talked about. Now, later on, Moses, in disobedience, is going to strike a rock again, but it's never called the staff of God there. God had nothing to do with that striking. God had told him to speak to the rock. This is the last time the staff of God was used appropriately. It's like the grand finale of this whole story of the staff of God, because it's not talked about ever again. Not in the book of Exodus, not in the entire Pentateuch, the first five books of the Old Testament. So this is really a big deal of what's taking place here. And now the staff of God is going to be used by Moses up on this high hill as a key to the battle. Now we need to understand very clearly, as we talk about the staff of God, it was not like a magic wand. The power was not in the staff. This was a very symbolic thing that revealed in a very clear way the power of the God of Israel. In and of itself, it had no power, but it pointed to and represented the power of God. And Moses is going to go up on that hill and hold this staff up as a very clear indicator of his dependence on God. And so let's read about that beginning in verse 10. Joshua did as Moses told him and fought against Amalek. And Moses, Aaron, and Hur went up to the top of the hill. So it came about when Moses held his hand up that Israel prevailed, and when he let his hand down, Amalek prevailed. But Moses' hands were heavy. Then they took a stone and put it under him, and he sat on it, and Aaron and Hur supported his hands, one on one side and one on the other. Thus his hands were steady until the sun set. So Joshua overwhelmed Amalek and his people with the edge of the sword. What an amazing victory here. But let's talk about what happened. What was the key to the battle in this situation? Was it the totally untrained army on the battlefield? Was that the key? Was it the army fighting harder, swinging harder, using better strategy? Was that the key? No, the army was very much involved. We don't want to discount that. They were very much involved. But that was not the key to victory. The key to victory became very clear. It was what was happening with the staff up on the mountain. And when Moses fully extended that staff, Israel prevailed. And when his arms came down, Amalek prevailed. And it didn't take very long for the three men, Moses and Aaron, who was Moses' older brother and a priest, and a man named Hur, who was their helper. It didn't take long for those three men to realize the connection. Arms fully extended, the staff of God made all the difference in the world. But the Bible says here that Moses' hands became heavy. You can imagine, you can only hold your hands up this high only so long. You can only hold them. I don't know how long you can hold them, but I can't hold them very long up there. And so they were very, I think, very strategic here. They got a rock, and they sat Moses down on it. Maybe the three of them discussed a solution here. How are we going to keep that staff fully extended? And they brought a rock, and Aaron went on one side and supported his arms fully extended, and Hur went on the other side and did the same thing. It makes a lot of sense to have him sit on the rock, because if Moses stood up, Moses would get tired of standing. Plus, they'd have to hold his hands clear up here. When he sits on a rock, it's a lot easier to support from the waist than it is from your arms fully extended. There's a lot of logic here in this thing, but they realized the key was the extension of the staff of God. And so, Moses' hands became steady, and they experienced this amazing victory. As we read in verse 13, so Joshua overwhelmed Amalek and his people with the edge of the sword. Who fought the battle? The army did. But it wasn't just the army. Who else fought the battle? Moses and Aaron and Hur up on that hillside. And what was the key to victory? This story could not be any more clear. It was what was taking place up on the hill. Did the men have to fight? Yes. Did the army have to work hard? Yes. But that would have accomplished nothing as far as victory without the intercession of Moses up on the hill. And there's a part of me that says, well, maybe that's the end of the story. Verse 13, because it seems like the story's at an end. They won, but it's not. Verse 14, then the Lord said to Moses, write this in a book as a memorial and recite it to Joshua, that I will utterly blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven. Moses built an altar and named it, the Lord is my banner. And he said, the Lord has sworn, the Lord will have war against Amalek from generation to generation. God established a memorial and so did Moses. God's memorial was something that needed to be written down. It was something that needed to be preserved for future generations, and it needed to be preserved accurately. But it wasn't just to be written down, it was also to be recited to Joshua, who was then the army general, but later would become the leader of the nation after Moses. Joshua needed to know this, and God said that I'm going to utterly blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven. That didn't happen in this battle. It didn't happen right away, but many, many years later, that's exactly what happened. Today, we read of Israel, but we never read in our newspapers about Amalek because they do no longer exist. They were totally, eventually wiped out. It took a long time, but eventually they were totally wiped out. Because God is not going to allow the plan of His redemption through the offspring of Israel to be compromised. The Messiah is still going to accomplish His purpose. So Moses went through and fulfilling God's memorial, but then Moses made his own memorial. Did you notice that? And it was an altar. He built an altar and he named it. And he named it, the King James says, Jehovah Nissi. And that being translated means, the Lord is my banner. And then Moses said, the Lord has sworn, the Lord will have war against Amalek from generation to generation. God's going to win this battle over Amalek. His plan is going to go forward. The Lord is my banner. Moses wanted those people, every time they saw that altar, to know the name of that altar, the Lord is my banner, and he wanted them to understand that that was a very important name. Now, what is a banner? A banner is something that is used to rally people together. It's kind of like a rallying point. It's kind of like a focal point. We kind of understand a little bit about that. A lot of times a banner was put up on some kind of pole. A lot of times it was like a flag. And we get a little bit of that in our culture today, and this illustration would have worked a lot better if yesterday had gone differently, but there's a banner that leads out the Nebraska football team. When they have a home game and they go through the tunnel walk and they're ready to head out onto the field, there's always at least one flag with a great big red or great big white N on it, and that's kind of the rallying point. That's kind of like the banner. That's kind of like the guys see that and it's like, yeah, we're Nebraska. We're going to give it everything we have. We have a strong tradition here. We're going to give it everything. In history, the banners are oftentimes flags. We read of our nation's history and we read about what took place in the War of Independence, where some of the patriots would sometimes be in battle and then someone would hold up the banner. And a guy holding up the banner might be shot by the enemy, but someone else would put down their gun and pick up the banner because seeing the flag of the United States was something that just motivate them to win this battle against Great Britain. And then we know that the flag of the United States of America played a very important role in World War I and World War II. We've all seen pictures of where men are erecting the flag up on a high hill so all of the army can see this banner. It's like, we're fighting for America, and the guys down in the trenches, they look up on the high hill and they see that banner, that flag, and they say, we're going to fight for all we're worth. We're fighting for our country and all that she stands for. We're fighting for freedom. And it drew them together and it motivated them to an even higher degree, and that's exactly what Moses is trying to do here. He's trying to remind the nation of Israel that the Lord is our rallying point. The Lord is our banner. The Lord is the one who provides the victory here. We have to do our part, but God is the one who ultimately has to make things happen, and we have to rely on Him or we're not going to win. He knew that. He just demonstrated that God was the only source of victory by extending his arms with the staff, and now he's doing it with a memorial, an altar. The key to the battle was not the army. The army was very important, but the army could not have done it without Moses. And Moses could not have done it without Aaron and Hur. And it took everyone working together to make this thing happen. But ultimately, none of them could have victory apart from the Lord. And so when Moses made this memorial, he did not make it as a memorial to himself as the leader of the nation. He did not make it to the army or to Joshua or to the soldiers or to anyone else, even though they all deserved a word of appreciation. He made the banner God alone. He is the one who made this happen. He is the one that gave us the victory. No question. And we need to understand that the same is true of us. In the challenges we face in life, in the difficulties we face in life, in whatever we face in life, it's not just about our activity. It's not just about us working hard. It's just not about us doing stuff. It's about us relying on the only one who can ultimately give us victory at all, and really relying on him. I think we need to understand that as individuals, we need to understand that as families, we need to understand that as a local church. You know, this fall, we're starting a number of ministries. Some of them are ones that we've done in past years, some of them are ministries that are brand new that we haven't done before. And I think it's important as we begin a new fall here to just be reminded once again that it's not just about doing stuff. It's not just about programs. It's not just about doing things. It's about remembering that the source of our victory, if anything of lasting value is ever going to happen through our lives individually and our lives corporately as a church, it's going to be because we're depending on our banner. We're depending on God, who is our banner, to do things that only he can do. And that has to be foundational to everything we do. That's why this week and the next 2 weeks, we are spending 3 Sundays focusing on the importance of dependence on God and the importance of prayer. Because it's not just about busy work. It's not just about ministry. It's not just about doing things. It's about trusting and depending on God to do things that only he can do. And that is most often reflected through prayer. As a local church, I really do believe that we want to do that. I really believe we want to rely on the Lord. I think if we were to talk to us as a group or talk to you as individuals, you'd say, yes, that's what I want. I want to rely on the Lord. But the question is, are we really doing that? Is he really our banner? Are we trusting in him like this, or are we trusting in him like this? There's a big difference. I really don't think that we're praying as individuals like we need to pray. I know that I fit that description. I know that I need to strengthen my individual prayer life, because that shows a direct correlation to my dependence on God. You know, when I preach, I have to prepare. I have to work hard at that. But if that's all I do and never pray, who do I think I am? And the same is true into whatever God has called you into. I don't think we're praying as individuals like we need to pray. I don't think we're praying as a church like we need to pray, because there's always room for improvement in those areas. And maybe if we are not praying like we need to be praying, maybe that's a reflection of the reality that maybe we're not relying on God like we really think we're relying on God. If you are never praying, are you relying on God? That's an important question. Let me ask you a couple of questions. And you don't have to answer out loud, but how many times this last week have you prayed for your family, some your family members, your immediate family members by name, and asked God to work in their lives and to show himself strong on their behalf? If they're unsaved, have you prayed for them to be saved? How often have you done that in the last week? I can tell you, your families need your prayer. They need you to serve them. They need you to do stuff for them, but it's not just about doing stuff for them. It's about depending on God to do things in your family's life that you could never do on your own. Let me ask you this question. How often have you prayed for this local church this last week? I can promise you that Pastor Matthew and Pastor Sonny and I, we really need your prayers. I can promise you that. We can't do this on our own. And thankfully, we don't have to because we have a lot of great people surrounding us. So many of you are such wonderful people out there, so many wonderful servants, but we need your prayers as pastors. Our elders and deacons need your prayers. Our staff needs your prayers. Our other leaders need your prayers. I would like in this next year to see us more and more become a prayer-saturated church, because I think it's foundational to everything. I think it's the key to victory. I think it's the key to everything, is our dependence on God. Does God want us to be active in serving him? Absolutely. But never can we stop depending on him. And if we never pray, maybe we're not depending on him like we should. When you receive email prayer requests from the church, some of them quite urgent, how many of you just stop right then or very soon afterwards and just pray for that need? How many of you, when you look at the bulletin and read the prayer column, how many of you take time to pray for any of the needs on that column? How many of you have prayed for unsaved people in your family or at your work or in your neighborhood and asked for opportunities to speak to them? All of those things show an amazing dependence on God if we're doing them. And my guess is that all of us need to be challenged in these areas. These are not comfortable questions to ask. And I'm not just asking them of you. I'm asking them of me. Is prayer, dependence on God, does it have the role that it should have in our lives individually and corporately? Because it's not just about working harder or swinging harder. It's about trusting God more fully. So let me ask you this morning, is God really your banner? Are you trusting him like this? Like this? Or are you trusting him like this? The answer to that question makes all the difference. And maybe there's just one area that God has spoken to your heart about today, and my encouragement to you is not to beat yourself up too much about this, because, man, we could just leave here all really bummed out, because, man, we have so far to go, and I'm in that with you. But what I'd like to encourage you to think about is, okay, what can I do? What are one or two things I can do starting today that's going to help me head in a stronger direction to show my dependence on God? Because no matter what you have to face in life, dependence on God is what brings victory. Let's pray. Father, you are amazing, you are almighty, and we are so foolish when we try to fix everything ourselves and do everything ourselves. And Lord, I pray that in a fresh, new way, although we know in our heads the importance of prayer it seems to me like in my life and in the lives of many I've talked to, prayer is the first discipline that so easily gets forgotten. And Lord, as we cry out to you in prayer and continually show our dependence on you, even as Moses did, Lord, I pray that you would just bring about amazing things in our lives individually and in our life as a church that can only be attributed to you. Lord, what a privilege to serve Almighty God, to have the resources of the God who created the universe available to us. And Lord, may we rest on you, not in ourselves, because only you are worthy of our trust. Lord, may you be our banner for your glory. Amen.